Instead, I was able to start a conversation with Noah that we continued later at home. After he acknowledged that he was scared, we talked about how he might feel if he did jump, thrilled and proud. How he might feel if he didn't jump, relieved on some level, but disappointed in himself. And critically, how he could go ahead in spite of his fears and jump anyway because it was important to him. That is, I first encouraged him to show up to his fear. Evolution has made us weary of heights for a reason, and there's no shame in needing time to adjust to the counterintuitive notion that a 1 meter leap into 4 meters of chlorinated water is a reasonable thing to do. Simply acknowledging what he was feeling changed Noah's relationship with his fear, allowing him to then step out, to create a dispassionate distance between the emotion and what he wanted to accomplish. This meant distancing himself from both the physical effects of his fear, the cortisol surge, the accelerated heart rate, and the hyperventilation, and from any self-doubting narratives that might have already hooked him at his tender age. From there, we examined his why, or the reasons he genuinely wanted to jump off the high dive. Fun, thrills, camaraderie. Along the way, I tried to assure him that the choice to jump or not to jump was entirely his. In spite of any peer pressure he might have been subjected to, the high dive was certainly not a have to, but it could be a want to. Noah and I turned the focus away from the outcome, whether success, splash, or a knee-trembling climb back down the ladder, and toward the process, a skill that he wanted to learn and which could be broken down into small steps. Day 1. Climb to the top of the ladder. Day 2. Walk out to the edge of the board. Day 3. Geronimo! But the next day, soon after we arrived at the pool, Noah simply took a flying leap. No trepidation, no trembling, no baby steps. And then he did it again and again with endless variations. The can opener, the cannonball, turning the teeter-totter principle into the high dive principle, as he thoroughly enjoyed himself while pushing the limits of his comfort zone all afternoon. As he had predicted during our conversation, he was immensely proud of himself, something I could see each time he waved down at me, grinning happily. Talking through his fear hadn't made him any less afraid, nor had examining his why changed his motivation. He had always wanted to jump, but until he had unhooked from the "I can't do it" narrative, he hadn't been able to fully engage with the strong, intrinsic desire that had been there all along. Of course, the biggest lesson Noah learned wasn't about diving or not diving. In acknowledging, yet distancing himself from his emotions and connecting with his why, he learned how to unhook and keep going despite his fear. When we guide our children through these basic steps toward emotional agility, we give them a lifelong tool. Every time they take a leap, not of recklessness or blind faith, but of eyes wide open volition in spite of fear, they practice fear walking, a skill that will help them face many other, much more significant emotional challenges later in life. Leading by example. When I ask parents what their biggest wish is for their children, most say, I just want them to be happy. To be truly happy, though, one must know simply how to be. And by that I mean to be effectively with oneself, centered, kind, curious, and not fragile in a changing world. We all know that love and structure help prepare a child for caring relationships and a successful career. But emotional agility offers a skill set that can translate love and structure into lifelong well-being. For parents, emotional agility provides a skill set for helping their child learn to thrive. Many of the studies that document the value of helping kids learn the skills to show up, step out, walk their why, and move on have been carried out over long enough periods of time to trace the development of resilience, morality, willpower, health, psychological stability, and relationship success well into adulthood. Happily, some of these conclusions have started to make their way into popular culture. A notable example is the animated movie Inside Out, which explores a girl's varied and changing emotions and shows how even the difficult emotions, like sadness, play an important role in shaping who we are. For parents, the most effective way to teach your children emotional agility is by practicing it yourself. This can be hard to pull off when your daughter is shrieking, "I hate you!" at the top of her lungs, or when your son comes home sobbing after a bad day at school. But these times actually offer you an even more valuable opportunity to model emotional agility. You model critical skills when you step out of your own emotions and respond calmly and compassionately, seeking to understand why your child feels the way he does, instead of rushing to respond to your own feelings. I have a PhD in this stuff, but trust me, I have been known not only to let my emotions get the better of me, but also to make the story about me. When Noah was an infant, I took him to the doctor for his first round of vaccinations. There Noah was in his calm cocoon of existence and at peace with the world. But the moment the first needle stuck him, he started screaming. To a new mother like me, his look of stark outrage seemed to say, "I trusted you. How could you do this to me?" I wanted to comfort him and rushed to say exactly what most parents do in these moments. "It's okay. It's okay." Noah continued to wail, and the nurse continued to do her job. But as she did, she turned to me and said something I'll never forget. "No, it's not okay. But it will be okay." She was absolutely right. How foolish of me to tell a person, even a baby, who had just been brought into a cold room and handed over to a strange woman who was now poking him with needles and terrifying him, that this was all okay. I was dismissing Noah's very clear and immediate, albeit pre-verbal, feelings, denying the very painful reality of his experience. In essence, I was telling him to bottle it. By the time my husband Anthony came home, Noah was well over his anti-vax protest. I, on the other hand, had been trashing myself for hours. I'd spent years studying emotions. I should have known better. Then again, all my geek work aside, I was a new mom, and this was the first time I'd ever seen my child in such distress. And however ineptly, I'd simply wanted to comfort him. As soon as Anthony stepped through the door, I told him the whole story. Can you believe? Noah was crying, and I said, "It's okay, it's okay." Anthony, who is a very practical doctor type, but also very funny, looked at me as I ranted. For a moment, he remained completely silent. But then an amused smile came over his face, and he responded, "It's okay, Sue. It's okay." Seeing you, seeing me. By being emotionally agile yourself, you will help your children learn the same skills. However, there are other, more proactive steps you can take. Remember display rules from chapter 3? These are the lessons we teach our kids about what is and is not an appropriate emotional response to any given situation. In extreme cases, a display rule might manifest itself through a directive like, "Buck up! Big boys don't cry!" which signals to a child that uncomfortable emotions are signs of weakness and to be avoided. In less obvious cases, we might try to dismiss a child's frustration or sadness. "Oh, he's just tired." Or, "She's hungry." Or, "It's a phase." Other times, we sugarcoat their distress. "Oh, honey, you know you don't really feel that way." Or, "It's okay. It's okay." Yes, guilty as charged. Even when these messages come from a place of love, they can still be counterproductive. We can also fall into the trap of trying to fix whatever's wrong. Our child comes home from school and says, "No one will play with me." And we might rush in with, "Don't worry, I'll play with you." Or we immediately set about contacting the parents of the mean girls to set up playdates or smooth things over. These are perfectly natural and understandable ways we try to remedy a loved one's unhappiness. However, while responding in these ways may solve the immediate problem, it deprives the child of the critically important opportunity to sit with her difficult feelings, to show up, step out, and learn from those sometimes heartbreaking real-world situations. They also inadvertently signal to the child, "I don't trust your ability to problem solve." On the other hand, when you take the time to let your child acknowledge her feelings and reassure her that these emotions are normal and healthy, you go a long way in helping your child develop the tools she will need to grow into a productive, emotionally agile adult. The largest of the ethnic groups in South Africa, the Zulu, greet each other by saying "Sawubona," which literally translates as "I see you." What is being implied is that by seeing you, I actually bring you into existence. I love this sentiment because it perfectly encapsulates the first step and one of the most critical of teaching emotional agility. By simply letting our children know that we see them in full, clearly and without judgment, we signal that we accept and validate their emotional experience. As an added bonus, we actually help them calm down when we do this, because children often exhibit a reduction in emotional intensity when a parent is emotionally present. So, despite our urge to fix things, to make everything better as quickly as possible, we are better off simply pausing and listening, showing our children by example how to create that space between stimulus and response. When a child feels fully seen and acknowledged by those around him, it's hard for him not to feel loved and secure. I'm sure we've all watched toddlers on the playground run off to explore something new, only to look back to make sure that their caregivers are still there, all the while trusting that they will be. It is this sense of security, what psychologists call secure attachment, that is at the heart of any child's ability to go forth bravely into the great wide world. Secure attachment is the stabilizer of a child's emotional life right on into middle school and adolescence, and on to the formation of his or her adult relationships. A child's sense of secure attachment, this idea that I, in all my glory, as well as all my stinkiness and imperfection, am loved and accepted, allows him not only to take risks in the world, but also to take risks with his own emotions. Knowing he will not be invalidated, rejected, punished, or shamed for feeling whatever he feels, he can test out sadness, happiness, or anger, and figure out how to manage or respond to each of these emotions in turn. A child who feels free to experience the full range of emotions without fear of punishment or the need for self-censorship learns some key lessons. Emotions pass. They are transient. There is nothing in mental experience that demands an action. Emotions are not scary. No matter how big or bad any particular feeling seems in the moment, I am bigger than it is. Emotions are teachers. They contain information that can help me figure out what matters to me and to others. To be clear, while raising emotionally agile children requires that you acknowledge and accept their feelings without rebuke, it does not mean you need to tolerate tantrums or irrational behavior. You can let kids know their feelings are real and just as important as anyone else's. I see you're really annoyed with your baby sister. And yes, I understand that right now you want to give her away without suggesting every feeling should be acted on. This is where the stepping out comes in. By helping your child learn to label the emotion, gain perspective, and put distance between the impulse and the action, you're reinforcing the idea that while they don't need to restrain their feelings, they do sometimes need to restrain their behavior. Again, this kind of compassionate, yet ever so slightly detached response can be challenging when your toddler is lying face down in the supermarket aisle, screaming and kicking, or when your teenager just climbed out of her bedroom window and disappeared on the back of a motorcycle with that Peterson kid. But for both parent and child, it's the showing up part that lays the foundation for the stepping out, the unhooking that keeps our toughest emotions from getting the better of us. How to think, not what to think. I recently asked my mom if she remembered the story I told earlier about the time I tried to run away from home and ended up walking around the block for hours on end. She laughed. Of course she remembered. Then she told me something I hadn't known. While I'd circled the block for all that time, she had actually been following me just half a block behind. I was only 5, after all, and there was no way she was going to let me wander the dangerous streets by myself. To her immense credit, my mother didn't try to minimize my upset, which might have taught me to bottle. Nor did she try to make everything right by placating me. Instead, she allowed me to live with what I was feeling and even let me exercise my own free will, however misguided it was. All the while, though, she maintained her invisible tether of protection and attachment by making sure I was safe, and she was ready to intervene in case of a threat. In other words, she kept me physically safe, but gave me the gift of emotional autonomy. Autonomy is a bedrock element of lifelong thriving and is critical to children's moral development. Autonomy means self-governance, or rule by the self. And in psychological terms, an autonomous person lives according to the choices he or she makes. But autonomy is different from mere independence. A teenager's cry of, "You're not my boss. I'll stay out all night if I want to," sounds very independent. But a behavior is not autonomous if it is driven by peer pressure, bad habits, compulsions, or chaotic emotions. Truly autonomous actions are those you fully own and endorse with your deepest self, without coercion from either the outside or your own unchecked impulses. The teenager who always comes home when she's told to, because she's afraid of being punished, or because she feels guilty about being disloyal to her parents, isn't acting autonomously any more than the teenager who violates his curfew as an act of rebellion. Instead, the teen who acts with autonomy, in this example, might be home on time because that's the rule, and it's one she believes is perfectly valid and reasonable. Here's how we can encourage autonomy in a child. Honor him for who he actually is, for example, someone who loves drawing, rather than who you wish him to be, for example, someone who loves wrestling. Give her a true choice wherever possible, which is not the same as not setting limits or not establishing expectations, or indulging her every whim. Provide a rationale for the decisions you make when no choice is possible. "Because I said so" is not an autonomy-supportive rationale for why your preschooler has to hold your hand when crossing the street. "Because you're small and drivers may not be able to see you, but they can see me" is. Minimize external rewards, such as stickers, toys, or cash, for doing things like peeing in the potty instead of a diaper, or doing homework, or getting good grades. The last two items on this list are especially key in helping children find the want-to motivations discussed in Chapter 7. Children raised in a barter or bribe economy, just like those raised in a command and control environment, don't develop the strong autonomous self that can create distance between real desires and pre-programmed responses. And it makes no difference whether the responses are rebellious or compliant. And people taught to act in the expectation of extrinsic rewards turn out to be less happy, less successful, and have less satisfying relationships than those who are internally motivated. Encouraging autonomy also helps kids to develop a why to walk, a set of values that is their own, separate from rewards and requirements. This is especially important as children are faced, and they surely will be, with more ambiguous choices, such as whether or not to take a creative risk, for which there's no certain payoff. The same is true for situations in which there are no predefined rules. You never said I couldn't borrow your car to drive to Tijuana. Only when kids are properly guided toward learning and trusting their own values can they discover their wise and want-to motivations, the ones that lead to genuine thriving. All this said, there are times when a child will encounter an immediate danger. Obviously, in those moments, your desire to encourage their autonomy will take a backseat to common sense interventions. When I ran away at age 5, my mother could see that I wasn't trying to cross the street and that I wouldn't get too far, so she was willing to give me some latitude. If I decided to leave home for good at 13, I'm sure she would have taken a much stronger stand against my desire to go free range. Raising children who care. Parenting with emotional agility is not just about expressing empathy for your child in the moment. It's about modeling empathetic behavior regularly so your children can learn to do the same. You might not see any reason why the first day at a new school should be scary, but you can acknowledge that your child sees it that way. By doing so, you both provide her with security and encourage her natural instinct toward taking other people's feelings into account. Why might the tough kids be trying to act so tough? Who else might be feeling lonely and out of place? This is the process that produces kids who, as they mature, notice the classmate who's been left out, the shy exchange student struggling with a language barrier, the cashier having a bad day, the elderly grocery shopper who needs help with a bag. Later on, they're likely to become attuned to even larger issues of justice and inclusion in the local community and society as a whole. But empathy and perspective-taking cannot be instilled by fiat. In a study at Cornell University, researchers introduced 3- and 4-year-olds to a sad puppet named Doggy. The children were then handed a prized resource, a star sticker. One group of children was presented with a tough choice of giving their sticker to Doggy or keeping it for themselves. A second group had an easier choice, to either give the sticker to Doggy or hand it back to the researcher. The third group was simply told that they had to share their stickers with Doggy. Later, when the children were introduced to another sad puppet named Ellie, they were each given 3 stickers and the option of sharing as many as they wanted. The kids who had earlier been in the first group and given the choice to share the sticker with Doggy or keep it for themselves gave more stickers to Ellie than did those from either of the other 2 groups. In other words, the children who had been given a free choice all along were more generous than those who had been coerced. Forcing your son to invite a lonely classmate to his birthday party, or threatening to punish your daughter if she doesn't apologize for an insensitive comment on the playground, may get you a quick result and a temporary feeling of relief. But only by letting your children act autonomously, encouraging them to dig deep to discover their genuine want to motivations, can you help them unlock their own potential for empathy. This also applies to such ethical basics as truth-telling. In a study of pairs of one 13-year-old and one parent, the teenagers were asked about their parents' treatment of them over the past few months. There was a direct connection between how much the parent tried to control his or her teen's behavior and thoughts, and how well the teen understood the value of telling the truth. Kids were more likely to understand the benefits of telling the truth and the costs of lying if they agreed with these statements. When my parent asked me to do something, he or she explained why he or she wanted me to do it. My parent gave me many opportunities to make my own decisions about what I do. And my parent was open to my thoughts and feelings, even when they were different from his or hers. On the other hand, those teens who reported a belief in the high costs of telling the truth agreed with the statements. My parent made me feel guilty for anything and everything. My parent refused to accept that I could want to simply have fun without trying to be the best. And when I refused to do something, my parent threatened to take away certain privileges in order to make me do it. The virtues of promoting autonomy can also be viewed from a purely practical perspective. You won't always be there with your adult child, holding his or her hand every step of the way, and helping him or her navigate every ethical quandary and choice. At least I hope not. Nor will you be there to help your kids step out and unhook every time they're confronted with a powerful emotion or an impulsive thought. When you're a child or even a teenager, you're usually pardoned for foolish, ill-considered stunts. But while a 16-year-old will probably be forgiven for letting the air out of the principal's tires once, a 26-year-old who does the same thing to the boss's SUV isn't likely to be treated as charitably. When I was about 8 years old, I stole a small amount of money from my parents. I still remember the amount. It was 2 South African rand, which in today's money is the equivalent of about $3. My parents figured out what I'd done after I came home with a stash of candy and an obviously phony story that a very generous friend had bought it for me. My parents took me for a drive, just the three of us, Mom and Dad in the front and me in the back seat, and had a very serious conversation with me. They spoke of how disappointed they were with my behavior and told me that stealing and lying were not things we did in our family. Then they helped me figure out how I could make it right, including paying them back and apologizing to the friend that I'd pulled into the mess. It was evident that they took the matter very seriously, but they were also very careful not to shame me in front of my siblings, and they didn't yell or use scare tactics. Instead, they were clear, calm, and I think conscious of what they wanted to achieve. By helping me understand the emotional impact on them and on my friend, and not simply lecturing me about how what I'd done was wrong, they allowed me to gain some perspective on my actions rather than adopting a defensive stance, a behavior that often leads to more lying. They stated expectations rather than doling out a punishment. As a result, I felt guilty but not ashamed, a critical difference, as we discussed in Chapter 4, and motivated to solve the problem. And if they had forced me to deliver one of those sorry, not sorry, style apologies, they might have heard the words they wanted to hear, but they wouldn't have given me the opportunity to examine and process the feelings that had motivated my behavior in the first place. The truth was that I felt isolated at school, and this loneliness was amplified whenever the gaggle of girls I most liked headed off together at recess to buy candy, which I didn't often have the money to do. Because my parents helped me face this discomfort, I was able to have a conversation with them not only about taking ownership of my behavior, but also about the strategies I might use to get to know some of my classmates better and to feel more a part of the fun without stealing. I also learned how to have a difficult discussion that yields a productive end, which is no small thing. Had my parents simply punished me, none of that growth would have happened. Even worse, I might have started to think of myself as a child who steals, or my parents might have done the same. By steering clear of this possibility, my parents kept the incident in its rightful place, as something that had happened once and an opportunity to learn. They met me where I was, not where they wanted me to be, and that made all the difference. Emotional coaching. As we've already established, raising emotionally agile children begins in helping them show up to all their feelings, including the difficult ones. While so much of showing up is about going to the emotion, how are you feeling? There is also that important element of emotional agility that is about moving on or going through. What are some options for dealing with this? This is when emotional agility meets the search for practical steps to deal with a situation, whatever it may be. Moving on is best achieved by encouraging your children to brainstorm. When you support them to find solutions on their own, solutions that are meaningful to them, they develop the autonomy that will help them navigate their world, as well as the sense of responsibility that comes with it. And here we come back to the idea of tiny tweaks, small changes that help your child take on challenges and move toward what is important. The key focus here is on the process, being open to experimentation, to giving things a try, and discovering what might be learned, rather than some ideal pass or fail outcome. If your child is worried about making friends at her new school, she isn't likely to hit it off with everyone at once. So you might ask her, where are good places to start connecting with people? For the adolescent navigating the often harsh world of teenage social media, with its inevitable arguments and name-calling, you might ask, what are some strategies you could use to manage people you disagree with? A while back, a colleague of mine, let's call him John, played in a father-son golf tournament with his son, who was 6 years old. The adults played against the adults, and the kids played against the kids. But about halfway through the course, John came across his son, Keith, weeping. John gave Keith a hug and gently asked, why the tears? But it was clear that no amount of cuddling and conversation on that green would get them to the heart of the matter in time to finish the tournament. So John suggested that it was okay for Keith to cry if he needed to. But he also asked if it was possible for Keith to cry and play golf at the same time. He promised his son that if he could get through the 9 holes, they would fully explore whatever was upsetting him as soon as the tournament was over. Keith agreed, and father and son split up again and played through to the end on their respective teams. Keith even did well enough to win a trophy. With a less savvy dad, this easily could have become a story about bottling, burying the difficult emotions and white-knuckling it through the game. Remember Tom Hanks in A League of Their Own, yelling, "There's no crying in baseball." Often, when we demand that weepy or angry kids behave in more socially acceptable ways, we inadvertently send them the message that their feelings don't matter to us. But John took a small, compassionate pause to acknowledge and accept, to show up to his son's distress. This was enough to help Keith step out and mindfully and compassionately be with his emotions, while still doing what he needed to do that moment, finish the golf game. When they later had time for a conversation, John discovered that his son had been upset because he'd lost a golf ball. In Keith's 6-year-old mind, balls were expensive, so the fairly minor incident had ballooned into a full-blown panic. John tells me now, many years later, he still reminds his son that it's possible to cry and play at the same time. In fact, that kind of self-compassionate playing through may be the essence of emotional agility. That's all. Malala. Until 2009, most people had never heard the name. But the Nobel Prize-winning Pakistani teenager has since become a universal symbol for bravery and strength of character. At age 11, Malala Yousafzai began writing a pseudonymous blog for the BBC about her life in northwest Pakistan, where the Islamic militant Taliban, which controlled the region, forbade most girls from going to school. In her blog, Malala spoke about the importance of education for girls. After a New York Times reporter made a documentary about her life in 2010, Malala received recognition worldwide, and within her own country, death threats. In 2012, the Taliban sent a gunman to kill her as she rode home on the school bus. When the assassin climbed onto the bus and threatened to kill every girl on it, Malala, who was 15, didn't hesitate to identify herself as the one he was looking for. He fired 3 times. 1 bullet struck her in the head. Malala's father, Ziadin, is an education activist himself, and Malala's parents had raised their daughter by example to stand up for what she believed in. As their daughter lay unconscious in critical condition, Malala's agonized father wondered if he had done the right thing in encouraging her activism. Her parents' only consolation was knowing that their daughter's why was so important to her that she was willing to look directly into the face of death. As Malala recovered from her wounds, her mother and father discovered that their courage in how they had raised their daughter was to their benefit as well. She consoled us, her father said in a speech shortly before Malala won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2014, its youngest ever recipient at the age of 17. We learned from her how to be resilient in the most difficult times. And lest you think his story does not apply to your own child, he added, "She is like any girl. She quarrels with her brothers. She cries when her homework is incomplete." Ziyadin's real message, though, was one every parent can take to heart. What has made Malala so special and so bold and so poised? Don't ask me what I did. Ask me what I did not do. I did not clip her wings. And that's all. Chapter 11. Conclusion. Becoming real. The children's classic, The Velveteen Rabbit, tells the tale of a stuffed animal's quest to discover what it means to be real. When the story opens, the rabbit is having a hard time fitting in with his owner's other toys. The little boy to whom the rabbit belongs lost interest in him shortly after receiving him, and the other toys, many of which have modern mechanical parts that make them seem and act real, intimidate the rabbit. After all, he's made of cloth and sawdust and hardly looks like a real bunny at all. The rabbit eventually finds a friend in the wise old skin horse who has lived in the nursery for longer than any of the other toys. "What is real?" the rabbit asks the skin horse one day. "Does it mean having things that buzz inside you and a stick-out handle?" "Real isn't how you are made," says the skin horse. "It's a thing that happens to you. When a child loves you for a long, long time, not just to play with, but really loves you, then you become real." "Does it hurt?" the rabbit asks. "Yes," the horse concedes. "But when you're real, you don't really mind being hurt so much." "Being real," he says, "doesn't happen often to people who break easily, or have sharp edges, or who have to be carefully kept. Being real requires that you get scuffed up a bit, maybe even become a little shabby." One night, the little boy can't find his favorite china dog to sleep with, so his nanny grabs the Velveteen Rabbit out of the toy cupboard and tucks him in with the young master. After that, the boy becomes inseparably attached to the rabbit, hugging him tightly in bed, covering the rabbit's pink nose with kisses, and taking him everywhere. The boy even brings him to play in the garden, and once accidentally leaves him outside all night. Through it all, the rabbit becomes increasingly grimy and threadbare. Eventually, the pink gets rubbed off his nose. At one point, the nanny tries to take the now filthy toy away, and the boy protests that the rabbit has to stay, insisting that he's real, which is, of course, music to the rabbit's satiny but now shop-worn ears. Eventually, thanks to magical intervention by the nursery fairy, the Velveteen Rabbit actually does become a real, living creature and hops off into the forest. Before, the rabbit was real to the boy. But now, the fairy says, he will be real to everyone. Those of us in the real world may not be able to tap ourselves with a magic wand and instantly transform ourselves into the people we most long to be. But if we practice emotional agility, we don't need magic, because emotional agility allows us to be our authentic selves for everyone every day. Emotional agility is the absence of pretense and performance, which gives your actions greater power because they emanate from your core values and core strength, something solid and genuine and real. We reach that level of real, that level of emotional agility, not through magic, but through a series of tiny steps in everyday moments over the course of a lifetime. Here's how you can start this journey today. Appoint yourself the agent of your own life and take ownership of your own development, career, creative spirit, work, and connections. Accept your full self, rubbed off nose, shabby ears, good and bad emotions, the whole package, with compassion, courage, and curiosity. Welcome your inner experiences, breathe into them, and learn their contours without racing for the exit. Embrace an evolving identity and release narratives that no longer serve you. Let go of unrealistic dead people's goals by accepting that being alive means sometimes getting hurt, failing, being stressed, and making mistakes. Free yourself from pursuing perfection so you can enjoy the process of loving and living. Open yourself up to the love that will come with hurt, and the hurt that will come with love, and to the success that will come with failure, and the failure that will come with success. Abandon the idea of being fearless, and instead walk directly into your fears with your values as your guide toward what matters to you. Courage is not an absence of fear. Courage is fear walking. Choose courage over comfort by vitally engaging with new opportunities to learn and grow, rather than passively resigning yourself to your circumstances. Recognize that life's beauty is inseparable from its fragility. We're young until we're not. We're healthy until we're not. We're with those we love until we're not. Learn how to hear the heartbeat of your own why. And finally, remember to dance, if you can. This is Susan David, PhD. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Emotional Agility, Get Unstuck, Embrace Change, and Thrive in Work and Life. This program was directed by Jamie Siniglia. Executive Producer, Dan Musselman. Text copyright 2016 by Susan David. Production copyright 2016, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.